Hello, I'm James Kamara-Sami. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Wednesday, the 11th of December. After the father and stepmother of Sara Sharif are found guilty of murdering the 10-year-old, we'll examine the lessons of the case and ask a forensic psychologist what leads a father to kill his own child. The UN Special Envoy to Syria has called on the transitional authorities in Damascus to be inclusive in order to avoid a new civil war. We'll hear from Syrians across the country, examine whether there are signs of retribution, and ask a former senior advisor to Donald Trump how the new US administration should approach events in Syria. Plus, the challenges of a clinical trial of puberty blockers, and peers vote on whether to do their hereditary colleagues out of a job. There are many distressing aspects to the case of Sara Sharif, the 10-year-old from Woking in Surrey, whose father and stepmother were today found guilty of her murder after 2 years of what were described as horrific suffering. From the injuries on her body, the human bite marks, the burn on her buttocks caused by an iron, to the blood-stained cricket bat and rolling pin with her DNA on it that were found at the family home. And then there is the phone call that her father, Irfan Sharif, made to police from Pakistan on August the 10th, 2023, the day her body was discovered, and which, by way of warning, is a disturbing listen.
Hello?
Yes, hello. Is everything okay?
Nothing is okay. Can you write on my address, please?
Take a deep breath and tell me what's happened.
I cannot. I killed my daughter. I killed my daughter.
Okay.
My daughter is dead.
Who's killed your daughter?
It's me.
Okay.
The father.
How?
I beat her up. It wasn't my intention to kill her, but I beat her up too much.
Okay, what happened? What led you to this all happening?
I think she was naughty over the last 3-4 weeks, and I was giving her for the stress that she to sort her out.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I did something, and she died.
Irfan Sharif calling there from Pakistan, saying at the end that he beat her because she had been naughty. Well, according to the Children's Commissioner for England, Dame Rachel D'Souza, the case has highlighted profound weaknesses in our child protection system. Sara was described as a happy, outgoing and lively child, but she was also a child on the social services radar even before she was born because of concerns of neglect and violence in the family, including violence against one of her older siblings. During her early years, Sara was in and out of foster care before going to live with her mother, Olga, after her parents separated. But a family court later ruled that she should live with her father and stepmother, despite knowing that history of violence. Her school later raised the alarm when Sara arrived with a badly bruised face. But after a 6-day investigation, the local council took no further action, instead calling on the school to monitor the situation. Well, shortly afterwards, Irfan Sharif took his daughter out of class and away from any potential monitoring to be homeschooled. So, what can be done to prevent cases like this happening again? Let's talk now to one of the country's leading voices on child protection, Sir Alan Wood, a former president of the Association of Directors of Children's Services. He's written several government reviews into child protection across the country. Good evening, Sir Alan.
Good evening.
What is your assessment of what went wrong in this case?
Well, it's difficult to know what went wrong because the safeguarding review will now commence following the proceedings of the court. So we'll have to wait until they came forward with their recommendations from that report. But what is clear, I think there are a few issues that are very clear about this. If we look at the national context, over the last 10 years or so, in fact for longer, about 52 children a year die from abuse or neglect at the hands of families or other people. And that number has stayed stable over that period. And so the question for us is, why is it we can get it right for so many children, but not for this small number? And when the independent review of social care took place, one of the issues it identified was whether we had enough child protection experts. We've got social workers, we've got police officers, we've got clinical people from the National Health Service working with children, but the issue is, have we got the sufficient skills in teams of expert child protection practitioners to identify this group of children who we seem to be missing every year. And the notion there is being trialled at the moment. The recommendation has led to a number of trials being placed, taking place across England to see if this model might work and help us to identify these children.
So expertise, having, I think, what you have called elite child protection in place is one aspect. What about the communication between different authorities being needing to be more joined up?
Well, I think this is a finding that comes from most reviews, that communication could have been better. The issue in this case, I think, which I hope they will look at very deeply, is who was listening to the school. Because on a number of occasions, the school identified that the child had been harmed, identified the child had been injured. And after inquiry and after discussion, the school were told to monitor the case. And I think that's a big issue across English schools, that we are not sufficiently taking notice of the reports that are coming to us from schools. My view is that we need to be much, much closer with schools. We should have social work expertise in our schools so that we can, at a very early stage, identify if there's a child in a family where things are going wrong, and we can pick it up at a very early time. Well, because the schools, particularly the primary schools, I would say, are the first to be able to notice and identify if a child is being harmed. And we must respond to them much more effectively than we have been able to do thus far.
Of course, in this case, the father, once the school was talking about monitoring based on this assessment from the council, simply took her out and said she was being homeschooled. Now, that the government has said it's introducing a register of children in home education, but is that enough?
No. Many years ago, 15 or so years ago, local authorities had responsibility for children who were being educated at home, which involved them being able to go into the child's home to see the provision that was being made, to meet the child, to talk to the child, and if there were any issues, they could be reported back to the children's services teams. At the moment, those facilities have been removed, and there is no the local authority social workers have no power to go into a home to check the education being provided or the safety of the child. A register alone will identify children who are being educated at home, but it won't give you the authority to go and check on the quality of that education and to check on the safeguarding issues that there may or may not be in that household.
So what would you like to see then?
Well, what I'd like to see is to restore the powers which allow the quality of provision that's being made for a child on home education to be brought back into service, so that the quality could be considered by experts and people who are knowledgeable about home education. Because we have got, you know, I don't want to criticise home educators, because we have so many of them so good for their children. But there's a small number who are not really home educating their child at all. They're keeping them away from the eyes of the authorities because they are doing things that they shouldn't be doing with those children.
Sir Alan, many thanks. Sir Alan Wood, former president of the Association of Directors of Children's Services. Well, perhaps the overriding question for most people listening to the awful details of the Sara Sharif case is, how on earth could a father do this to his own child? We're joined now by Dr. Naomi Murphy, consultant clinical forensic psychologist, who's worked with men who've committed similar crimes in a high-security prison over the last 25 years. Dr. Murphy, welcome to the programme.
Hello.
Do the details of the Sara Sharif case resonate with some of those you have come across?
They do, and sadly, I mean, this is quite an extreme case, but even so, you know, they're not so rare that we would not be bothered about them. It's you know, still too frequent.
And why? Why have you found that parents end up harming the very people that they are supposed to be protecting?
Well, being a parent can be extremely challenging at the best of times, for any of us, actually. We might find it hard to know how to soothe our children when they're distressed. We might not know how to impose boundaries or how to cultivate a sense of respect for our authority. We might feel embarrassed by their behaviour or disappointed if they don't meet our academic expectations. But parents who abuse their kids have tended to have their own histories of being abused in childhood. I'd say that's pretty universal, actually. And this is significant because they've not been exposed to appropriate role models themselves of parenting. And also, more importantly, we learn how to cope with our emotions from how our parents respond to ours. So if they're comforting and supportive, we learn how to cope with our emotions. If they're unresponsive or they punish us for being distressed, we tend to learn to avoid our feelings or channel them all, including the vulnerable ones like sadness or disappointment, into anger, because that makes us feel more powerful and in control. And that's sometimes even amplified by hate.
But hate directed towards their own children, I suppose, is what people find so hard to get their head around.
I know it's it seems so at odds with how we expect people to be drawn to protect children. But I think the kind of parents who can't cope with their emotions are more likely to feel threatened or slighted and possibly even humiliated by their child's behaviour, and even read slights into quite innocuous cues. They're more likely to read intent behind the child's actions rather than see the child is just behaving like a child. And then once the child is punished, they're likely to also find it hard to tolerate their feeling of guilt and perhaps become quite angry with the child for evoking that guilt. And the child can also serve as a reminder of the other parent, which might evoke rage or even be a way of enacting revenge on the other parent, as we've sometimes seen.
As you say, I mean, this kind of extreme case is very rare, but people are wondering, how can you spot the signs? Can you spot the signs that someone has a propensity to go this far when it comes to harming their own children?
In terms of the actual extent of it, maybe not, but I think, you know, we can see people who are a risk to others. There's a sense of people who are easily hurt and slighted, that can't, you know, that fly off the handle very easily, perhaps kind of like become quite menacing in their silence, you know, and staff that engage with parents who are physically abusive often report feeling quite intimidated or threatened. And sometimes that makes staff, you know, professionals back away from a family because they find it very difficult to challenge intimidating parents. I think the signs are often there, but maybe not to the extent of predicting murder, else people would intervene, I'm sure.
Dr. Naomi Murphy, a consultant clinical forensic psychologist, thanks very much indeed for joining us. And coming up later on in the programme...
It is a scandal that medicine was given to vulnerable young children without the proof that it is safe or effective or through the rigorous safeguards of a clinical trial.
Today, the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, said a ban on puberty blockers being prescribed to under-18s questioning their gender is to be extended indefinitely and across the UK. He also announced a new world-first clinical trial for the drugs. We'll hear about what that might involve. But let's turn to Syria now, because after overthrowing the old Assad regime, what kind of new Syria are the transitional authorities, led by the Islamist Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, forging? Today, the UN envoy to that country, Geir Pedersen, called on them to strive for a more inclusive process to avoid a new civil war. Well, although the takeover at the weekend was largely peaceful, the more complex nation building is happening as fighting between Kurdish forces and groups allied to Turkey is raging in the north of the country. And there are reports of armed groups carrying out retaliatory attacks on civilians in areas once considered loyal to the Assad government and family. Today, rebel fighters destroyed the tomb of one of those family members, the late president of Syria, Hafez al-Assad, the father of Bashar, who was deposed and chased out of the country at the weekend. Well, today we received these two voice messages from Syrians in different parts of the country. Oannes Shehryan is an Armenian Christian and a journalist for a state news agency. He left his hometown of Aleppo out of fear as HTS forces moved in, but he's now returning.
I left Aleppo because Assad's media said that they are terrorists, they will kill us as minorities in Syria. So I left for being safe. I came back because my family said that they are safe because new leaders promised minorities from different denominations, especially Christians, that they will be safe and they will continue their lives as they were. We have fears and hopes. We have hopes because new authorities said that we will be safe. But I have a fear if our future will be in the hand of government led by one group of people, not all groups of Syrian society. This is worries of all Syrian people.
The view of one Syrian person. Let's hear from another now. Wahed Hatem is a tutor at Tishrin University in the former regime stronghold of Latakia.
This falling was like an earthquake, real earthquake. After this war, we deserve a good life in the future, but it is not clear. We feel that the future is dark for us.
Well, joining us now is Mina Alami from BBC Monitoring, who is very much across everything that is happening in Syria at the moment, has a long history of covering events there. And Mina, if you're going to help us now understand the complex picture of what's happening in that country at the moment. Let's start with who is in control. We know who is running things in Damascus, but give us a sense of who's in control of different parts of Syria at the moment.
As you said, the group that is in control of Damascus, and I would say currently most of Syria, is HTS, which is the group that used to rule Idlib province in northwest Syria, and they have set up, their so-called cabinet that was in Idlib. They have now said the prime minister in Idlib will be the prime minister in Damascus, and the same for the rest of the ministers. So we know that HTS is playing a leading role in the current structure. However, the country is controlled by different groups. So in the north, we have the Turkey-backed rebel groups that have been making advances on Kurdish-held areas. So the Kurds are currently in the northeast, specifically in Hasaka province. They've been pushed out actually today. Since yesterday, they were pushed out of Deir ez-Zor province in the east. You have rebels in the south. And I think the difficulty now, of course, it's not completely clear who controls what area specifically, but I think the difficulty is that because the transition, the move from one government to a new structure has been so almost sudden that even if there is one group that is in control in Damascus, it doesn't necessarily have control over the various groups in other parts of the country, knowing that there are also small groups, jihadist ones, Islamist ones across the country. And there's IS that's also active in Syria.
Indeed. And what are the authorities in Damascus, at least, saying about retribution or indeed about reconciliation?
So the message that they put out immediately, almost, you know, when they took over Damascus, was one of reassurance, of reconciliation, forgiveness. That was the focus. There were messages to the Alawites, which is the minority sect of Bashar al-Assad, messages to Christians, the minorities. But also on the 9th of December, there was they issued an amnesty to all soldiers, to conscripts specifically, but that really ruffled the feathers of hardliners, both in, you know, the HTS ranks, but also in Syria more broadly. And they said that this was unfair to the victims, to the families of victims, that you are issuing this kind of very soft message. And then so the following day, HTS leader issued another message and said, there will be punishment to officials who were involved in war crimes and human rights abuses, and that we will put out a list, and we will demand for anyone who's abroad to be extradited and brought back, and that they will face justice. So there was that message trying to kind of reverse and address the anger about the amnesty.
That's what's coming from the top. But in terms of what's happening on the ground, what are you hearing? There have been some reports, have there not, of retribution taking place against Assad loyalists?
Yes, indeed. I mean, we've seen, so I monitor a lot of these sources on the messaging app Telegram, and we have seen quite a few very graphic clips that we haven't independently verified, but clips claiming to show individuals who are said to have been, you know, members of the former government and who had been involved in violations and atrocities, you know, being lynched or being killed or being, you know, there's summary execution. And it's not clear who these people, you know, the individuals carrying out these, you know, these acts of violence are. Some of them are in militant fatigues. They seem to be almost like from within, you know, a militia or a militant group, and they are carrying out these executions. And there are calls from, you know, amongst hardliners on Telegram who are based in Syria, calling for such revenge attacks and actually calling for defiance of the HTS message of forgiveness and saying that, you know, you need to go out and you need to take revenge. So it's kind of like vigilante action. Some of them are telling others, do not publicize this, do not put it on social media. Others are saying, you know, this is really bad publicity for the new Syria. You know, we're trying to send out a different message to the outside world. And I think the truth is it's going to be very difficult even for HTS, even if it is trying to exert some kind of control, to be able to control these very disparate groups in various parts of the country, as well as the anger and, you know, feelings of wanting to take revenge on former government members.
Mina, many thanks. Mina Alami from BBC Monitoring. Well, let's take a closer look now at one of the patchwork of groups in Syria, the Kurds. They, as Mina was saying, have suffered a series of military defeats in recent days, including in the eastern city of Deir ez-Zor, where the HTS group says it has taken control. A spokesman said that US-backed Kurdish fighters had withdrawn from the area. One top Kurdish commander has even accused his American allies of abandoning them. Well, I've been hearing more about the challenges facing Syria's Kurds from Vladimir van Willenberg. He's a Dutch journalist. He's based in Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan.
The Kurds are in the north of Syria. There are around between 2 to 3 million Kurds in Syria. They have been a major ally for the U.S. Against ISIS since 2014. And now with the fall of Assad, they are afraid they're going to be a target for Turkish-backed groups.
Well, what has happened since Assad fell?
So the Kurds were initially quite happy with the fall of Assad, like most Syrians. But afterwards, there were more attacks by Turkish-backed groups on Kurdish-controlled positions. And so one town that was held by the Kurds fell. And now the Kurds are worried that the Turkish-backed groups, they could continue their attacks, although U.S. officials had an agreement with Turkey to stop these attacks by Turkish-backed groups.
Because the Americans have been the Kurds' most important allies and vice versa, right?
Exactly, yeah. The Kurds played a big role in fighting ISIS, not only in Syria, but also in Iraq. And especially in the Battle of Kobani, the Kurds, they delivered ISIS a great blow. But now, after 2019, since ISIS has been territorially defeated, there's a risk for the Kurds that at some point the US will say, okay, ISIS is finished and now we're going to leave.
And what do we know of the relationship between the Kurds, if there is one, and HTS and those who are in control in the capital?
The Kurds, they have fought with the predecessor of the HTS, but the Kurds in this current situation, they have said that they had dialogue actually with the HTS. And so far, since the fall of Aleppo and now also the fall of the regime so far, they haven't had any fights with the HTS. So maybe they had some backdoor deals because there are still two Kurdish neighborhoods in Aleppo under Kurdish control, which the HTS didn't attack yet.
What are they fearing or expecting from the change in the White House in January?
They're afraid that something could happen like in 2019 when the U.S. withdrew from Syria, but then at that point they came back again. But so far it's not clear what Trump is going to do, because there are some people in the new Trump administration that are in favor of Kurds and that think they're the main ally against ISIS. And you saw, for instance, Senator Graham warning against attacking the Kurds by Turkey. But then you also have some people that say that we have nothing to do in Syria because the U.S. troops should not be in Syria because it just makes them a target. But we should not also forget there are U.S. troops in many other parts of the world, for instance, in Korea, where there are thousands of troops, and in Syria, there are just 900.
What's your sense of how the Turkish leader Recep Tayyip Erdogan might want to use the current situation in terms of his relationship with the Kurds?
Erdogan, he, from the beginning of this conflict, he always warned that he didn't want to have a second northern Iraq, because in Iraq, the Kurds already have an autonomous region. He didn't want the Kurds to have the same in Syria. So he's opposed to a Kurdish autonomous state-led in northeast Syria, especially because he considers it as close to the insurgent group, the PKK. So I don't think he wants to accept this and he wants to further weaken it. But because the Kurds became the main ally of the US against ISIS, it was difficult for him to undermine this relationship because the Kurds, they suffered a lot and they gave a lot of lives in the fight against ISIS.
Vladimir von Vilchenberg, who's author of The Kurds of Northern Syria. Well, for the perspective of someone close to the incoming US administration, I've been speaking to Fred Flights. He was chief of staff of the National Security Council during Donald Trump's first term in the White House. He's now vice chair of the America First Policy Institute. So how does he view the HTS rebels and the transitional government?
The situation is very unclear. We've seen some positive signs. This group claims it has reformed and is moderate and wants to hold free elections and will be inclusive. But it concerns me that HTS is a former Al-Qaeda offshoot and its leader has a $10 million bounty on its head. Is this group going to bring back strict Sharia law? Is this group going to be at war with Israel? We don't know yet. So I'm very cautious.
Are there certain signs then that you would be looking for as guarantees of good intention?
Well, I think we have to see how it treats its people. How does this group treat minorities? And bear in mind that this government that the HDS group largely will be setting up in a large swath of Syria. Large portions of Syria will not be controlled by it. This is still a fragmented country. Will HTS be at war with other rebel groups in other parts of the country, especially Kurdish rebel groups? That's a big concern.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about the Kurdish groups. They have, of course, been relying on the United States for support. There are still 900 or so American troops in northeastern Syria. What do you think should happen with them?
You know, I don't have an answer for that right now, and I don't want to speak for the Trump administration. I think that Trump's team is going to look at that very closely. I'm with President Trump that the U.S. should stay out of it in case this becomes another Iraq. Until we know what's going on here, I don't think the United States should be getting involved.
In terms of the kind of support for the Kurds, is that something that should continue, whether or not that means American troops being in place?
You know, I don't have anything else to add to this. I have to see where the Trump administration is going to come down. But I think Trump has been pretty clear that the U.S. should not be involved in this conflict.
How concerned are you about whether ISIS is going to use this moment to regroup and become a threat, not just to Syria, but to the broader region and indeed beyond?
I don't think that's going to happen because the ISIS pockets in Syria are fairly small and ISIS really has been eviscerated. But I do support what the Biden administration did and the airstrikes it conducted against these pockets of ISIS fighters.
Of course, another country which has been carrying out airstrikes, lots of them in the last few days, is Israel. There's been some criticism of the extent to which it has moved its forces beyond the internationally recognized buffer zone between the Golan Heights and Syria. The UN has said this violates the ceasefire between the two countries. Does that concern you?
Well, I haven't heard any criticism of that. And Israel moved into this area temporarily. It's a buffer zone, and it wants to make sure that entities very hostile to Israel don't occupy this area.
The UN and others, though, have expressed concerns about whether they are going further than they need to simply to guarantee their own security.
Well, I think I haven't heard criticism like that in the United States. This entire development is a victory for Israel. Israel established Israeli deterrence by eviscerating Hezbollah, by driving Iran out of the country, with the Russians distracted by Ukraine. Assad had no one to defend him any longer. And I think this is a great win for Israel. It's a great win for regional security.
Fred Flights, vice chairman of the America First Policy Institute, former chief of staff of the National Security Council under Donald Trump in 2018. Now, back in May, the then Conservative Health Secretary, Victoria Atkins, put a stop to the prescription of drugs which delay puberty, known as puberty blockers, to children questioning their gender. That followed a review of gender identity services by the paediatrician Dr. Hilary Cass. She concluded there was remarkably weak evidence to support the use of the drugs by children with gender dysphoria. Well, today, the current Labour Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, told the Commons he was making that ban indefinite for under-18s across the UK.
The Cass review made clear that there is not enough evidence about the long-term effects of using puberty blockers to treat gender incongruence to know whether they are safe or beneficial. That evidence should have been established before they were ever prescribed for this purpose. It is a scandal that medicine was given to vulnerable young children without the proof that it is safe or effective, or through the rigorous safeguards of a clinical trial.
And he confirmed that there would be a clinical trial of the drug beginning next year, and that would be the only exception to the total ban on giving it to children. But that trial presents its own set of challenges and controversies. Newsnight's former health correspondent Deborah Cohen, currently a senior visiting fellow at LSE Health, has written about that for the BBC website. And when we discussed the issue earlier today, she began by explaining what puberty blockers are.
They're known scientifically as gonadotropin-releasing hormone analogues, a bit of a long word there, but they work on the brain to stop the rise in sex hormones, that's estrogen and testosterone, that accompany puberty, and that's what's responsible for periods starting, breast forming in girls, or in boys, their voice breaking. Now, for years, they've been prescribed off-label, and that means for use that they weren't actually licensed for, to young people with gender dysphoria. And that's those people who feel their gender identity is different from their biological sex. Now, one of the key reasons for giving them was to allow a young person time to think by delaying the onset of puberty so they could work out what their next steps were. And one of the key things that Hilary Cass found was there hadn't been high quality evidence, and Wes Streeting alluded to that today, that the evidence was poor and it was a scandal, I think the words he used, that a clinical trial hadn't happened before.
You've outlined that after the Cass report, that's when there was a pause on using them. Wes Streeting's gone further than that now. For someone who's followed this closely, was there any surprise in that?
Possibly not. I think they're going to be given as part of a clinical trial. It's been divided whether a clinical trial should happen in the first place. There's a view from one group of people that it's too high risk to do that. We don't really know what we're treating. There's another group that think that actually there's evidence that these puberty blockers help people and it's unethical to withhold a treatment and make people go into a trial. But there's another group of people who think, well, actually, we've got low quality evidence. And what we do in medicine is when we've got low quality evidence, we go and generate high quality evidence. So it's possibly not a surprise that he's done a ban. But what's interesting is he has doubled down on the fact that the NHS is going to go ahead and do a clinical trial.
You've outlined some of the issues with the trial. I mean, what would you say the main practical and ethical ones are?
It's a very hard trial to do, and it is fraught with complexities. One of the key arguments is for a randomized control trial, ideally, you've got different groups. One group would have a placebo, so that would be a dummy injection. And one argument is whether a placebo group is feasible. So if a young person doesn't get a puberty blocker and notices their body changing, will they continue in the trial or will they drop out or try and seek puberty blockers from elsewhere? And that would undermine the validity of the results. So that was one of the key questions. There's different ways of doing a clinical trial. One argument was, well, we don't know the best time in puberty necessarily to get the drugs because you go through stages, they're called the Tanner stages. So what's the best time to get it? Where it's going to make somebody possibly alleviate their gender dysphoria, their symptoms. One of the key questions is the extent to which a young person's mental health might be improved if they're happy with the body. And what role does a puberty blocker play in that? So they might measure self-confidence and self-esteem. But as well as getting the personal views from the young people and the parents, the trial might measure actual real life changes, such as time spent in education, time spent with the family and friends. But that's obviously the perceived benefit. You also have to look at the harms. And we know there's some evidence that it reduces bone density. And there's also questions around brain development. So they'd need to measure the impact of that. That's one outline. So you have different stages of puberty. The other one is there's a delay. So if you go into the trial, you get the drug straight away or you have them after a delay. And during that delay, the young person receives psychological or social support and see if that alleviates the gender distress. And they might make a different decision after a delay with social and psychological support. And if they still want to go onto puberty blockers after that point, they can. But it begs a much bigger question is about what we do about the long-term evidence, because
This is where one of the issues around ethics comes in. Can a young person consent to ultimately having a treatment that will impact their fertility in future life and loss of sexual function? So there needs to be long-term follow-up in many ways.
That was Deborah Cohen. The House of Lords Hereditary Peers Bill, which has been through the Commons, will abolish the 92 seats reserved for members of the upper chamber, the Lords, who are there by right of birth. It delivers on a Labour manifesto promise, and it's been promoted as the first step in a process of reform. Well, our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Curran, has been following the debate and joins us now. So, Sean, what's happened today?
Well, it's been a very long day in the House of Lords. So many peers wanted to take part in the second reading debate on this bill. It's called the second reading debate. In fact, it was the first opportunity peers had had to discuss the general principles in this bill. So many of them wanted to take part, they actually had to start the day 4 hours early. So peers started the day at 11 o'clock. And I can tell you that at 12 minutes past 10, this bill cleared its first hurdle in the House of Lords. It's one of the unwritten rules in the House of Lords, one of the conventions that government bills always clear this first hurdle without a big vote. People don't attempt to block it. That's what happened this evening. But they'd had a very, very lively debate. Lots and lots of speakers. One of the speakers was the author of House of Cards, the creator of House of Cards, Michael Dobbs, who sits as a Conservative peer. And he employed a colourful turn of phrase as he argued against the bill.
Are the government going to say to our hereditaries, thank you for your contributions, for your expertise, the invaluable experience of generations. You leave this place with your head held high. That would be a beautifully British way of doing things. Or will the hereditaries be sent away with their heads in a basket, guillotined in front of the mob to provide a gotcha moment?
So, have to stress that is not one of the government's proposals, but that's an indication of the kind of language that was being used. Another peer described the bill as a drive-by assassination.
Yes, we're coming up to Christmas. I'm not going to make sort of turkey comments, but what about the tone? You said it was lively, Sean. How lively?
It was extremely lively. We did have one hereditary peer who described themselves as a turkey who's being asked to vote for Christmas. There was a lot of very colourful language used by opponents of the bill. We had mention of the Cray twins. There was talk of a purge. Basically, Conservative peers were arguing that this was a bad bill. They said it would damage scrutiny. The government pushed against all of that. They said it wouldn't change the constitution or the makeup of the House of Lords. It would simply remove the hereditaries. And they've argued that this is unfinished business from 1999, when Tony Blair's government got rid of most of the hereditary peers.
So briefly, Sean, I mean, is that sort of it now? Is it going to go through?
Far from it. It has gone through the Commons without any changes, but there are weeks, if not months, of scrutiny to go in the House of Lords.
Sean, thanks for that update. Our parliamentary correspondent, Sean Curran, there. And that is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. For now, from me and from everyone here on the programme, have a very good night.